Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton and our producer, Katie Galley, for another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, got a bunch of old friends here today.
Yeah, we certainly do. This is going to be a fun segment. First up on Atlanta Business Radio this afternoon, we have with us entrepreneur, author, and just all around good guy. He's got a new book out called What You Know About Startups Is Wrong. Please join me in welcoming back to the Business Radio X microphone, Mr. KP Reddy. How are you, man?
I'm great. Thanks for having me again.
Well, KP, I read your book over the weekend, and this you coined a word that I had never heard before, but maybe you had stole it from somebody else, but pre-tirement.
Pre-tirement.
And that seems to be kind of the catalyst for the book or helped you form it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I kind of... You know, I went through a really rough divorce and decided to take a year and a half off and just be dad. And I told people, like, in that process, I kind of said, why are we going to wait till right before we die to retire? We should, like, pre-tire several times before that.
Several times. So it's not a one-time
thing. No, it's not a one-time thing. That's my threat to my investors and partners.
That's right. Like,
I might pre-tire this week.
So now... So you went through a kind of a difficult time and you said, let me just take a break and regroup.
Right.
Was that the plan? So you pulled all the ripcord and you just kind of didn't do anything?
I did nothing. I was in yoga class a good bit. I was MMA fighting for
MMA?
A little bit. Yeah. So it was like two, you know, of course, I'm an entrepreneur. So
right. The yin and the yang. Girl.
Yeah. So I did that and then they told me I was too old. They said I took a punch really well. I just didn't heal fast enough. So.
The recovery. It's
recovery.
All about the recovery.
It's all about recovery.
And then, so you, after that, how did you kind of ease yourself back into the workforce?
So actually, I didn't want, like, I had
you
zero,
didn't want it to end?
I had zero interest in going back to work. And then a good friend of mine, Blake Patton, who runs Tech Square Ventures here in town, at the time was running Georgia Tech's ATDC. We've been friends for 20 years. And he's like, I get it. Tough time. You got to start doing something. You can't not do anything. And by the way, the startup community is starting to get vibrant again. Like, why don't you come volunteer? I volunteered. Then they gave me a job, like a part-time job. Mm-hmm. And then they gave me a full-time job, which included healthcare benefits, which is tremendous.
That was unusual.
And then through a series of events, they put me in charge. So they let the guy that was running it go. Mm-hmm. Blake had already moved on and I got put in charge. So that kind of got me going. It was a great soft landing because my days consisted of... growing my own stevia and like doing whatever, you know, whatever.
And hanging out with your family.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely. I was fresh breakfast for the kids every morning and cooking a fresh meal every night. And I was the best soccer mom ever, you know, like all of it.
So now, how was that when you were kind of decompressing a little bit? Was it difficult to have the mentality of an entrepreneur where it's go, 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 you know, 24/7, that's all you're thinking about to, now, the only thing I'm thinking about is it going to be scrambled eggs or, you know, over easy in the morning?
I mean, I just disconnected from all of that.
And so you were able to just kind of just step back and not kind of be type A in that world as well?
Absolutely not. I mean, and every once in a while, I mean, I had a great ecosystem of friends around me that the minute I started to get a little tweaky about like wanting to, you know, I'm going to make the best scrambled eggs ever. You know,
right. Like watching 10 YouTube videos.
I'm going to be the best dad. Once I started getting, it's funny, the first time I started getting into yoga, I was like, so how do we keep score? Like,
right.
Who's winning?
High five. Great job.
Like, no, there's no winning in yoga, apparently.
So did, now that you kind of are back into it, what are you taking from that kind of experience and maybe learning from, you know, past KP?
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest thing that I've done for myself and have to remind myself of and other entrepreneurs is just this idea of the hustle, right? The hustle. So I started writing this book really was just a way to document for my kids. It was not the idea of a book. A friend of mine in PR, I was like, hey, can I write any good? Like, take a look at this. She's like, it's not bad. This is great content. And so she hooked me up with a publisher and I really didn't want to do it at first. And then... because it's like therapy, but then you find out everybody else is going to read it too.
Right. This is in public. Therapy in public.
Yeah, exactly. But I did a simple thing. I went on Instagram and did search for hashtag startup life. Mm-hmm. And you see all these weirdos posting stuff like five Red Bull cans, like right. startup
life. I haven't slept in 4 days.
Right, I haven't slept in four days. Right. Like, what is that? Like, go sleep. Like, I would go in and comment, like, please go sleep. It's not good for you. Like, you know. And I think we perpetuated this, you know, this Shark Tank culture, which I have to remind people, Shark Tank is a TV show.
Right.
Like, it's entertainment. There's no business being done there. It's a big game, right? And you have Gary Vee and all these people, like, telling people to hustle and this and that. And it's like, yeah, it's a great way to, like, have a miserable life.
So now, in your life now, it sounds, I mean, it's so funny to have known you for many years now. Your tone is just, the vibe is totally mellow. This wasn't KP, you know. KP wasn't this chill. Yeah.
No, I mean, I mean, I think that's what I try to do in the book is like, here's how old me used to handle things. Like, you know, yelling at salespeople that were sick that hadn't hit their number. I was like,
excuses are for losers.
Yeah, like, what's wrong with right. me? Like, so yeah, being really hard on people. And right now it's just been more about fit. And, you know, I mean, I still have 12 companies and the venture fund and a million things, and I'm never in Atlanta anymore, it feels like. But I try to keep it all in kind of in a groove.
And then, so your level of happiness, I would imagine, is now through the roof?
It ebbs and flows, right? I mean, that's the thing, like this idea that you hit some goal of, you know, oh, I'm enlightened. And I mean, I was telling someone, I had a birthday party last Monday and for the book release. And of course, my girlfriend made me speak, which I was like not happy about. But she was like, no, you got to say a few words. And I just said, like, look, you know, part of this process has been that I use the book to remind myself of what I stand for sometimes, because it's very easy. When I'm in deal mode, it's very easy to get sucked back into kind of old me. And then I literally pull out my book and have to remind myself. Like,
or now the MMA folks just hit you over the head with it. Right?
So was there a chapter or two that was harder to get together for you than some of the others? Or did they all come real easy?
So the hardest part was I committed that I wasn't going to be negative about other people. If there was anything negative that happened, it was going to be about me. I wasn't going to like throw other people under the bus or talk negative about other people, but still try to get the stories out there in a very positive way. So, you know, I was the dummy that did X, Y, and Z, not this other person, and then really try to keep the narrative around that as much as possible.
So now an important component of your strategy about startups, I think, is the value of the people and how to work with people in a more productive manner. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the fundamental thesis is once you become an entrepreneur, once you ring that bell, there's no going back. You can decide, I'm going to go back and get a corporate job. You'll be miserable. There's no going back. So it's really a marathon. It's not a sprint. And really, it's the relationships you build along the way. I mean, my first company, we went from 2 to 1,200 people in 3 years. I still keep in touch with a vast majority of those people. And it's hard, right? It's constantly, it's a little bit easier now with social media. At least you think you're in touch.
Right.
But we, you know, those relationships that build on, because these are projects. I try to tell startups, don't call them companies. Don't name them. Don't do any of those things.
Because that puts too much emotional pressure or
so much attachment.
It?
Yeah. So it's this idea of, you know, exhibiting detachment from your startup and exhibiting a lots of attachment to the people. Mm-hmm. Because this project may not work out, didn't work out. Sorry. Hey guys, you want to go do something else? And then you just keep moving. And
that's right. So it's the relationships that you're kind of elevating as the most important thing.
Right.
Over whatever the project may be.
Right, it's a project.
So now, when you're working on a project and you're all in and you see some of your people kind of exhibiting some of your behaviors of the past, how do you manage that?
Oh, we go for walks.
Go for walks? What's a KP ready walk look like?
I mean, a lot of it is like, so you just kind of blew up in that meeting. So how do you feel about that? Like, do you feel great about that? Like, how do you, like, did you feel like you had to be this big jerk to prove your, you know, like what? If that's you and that's what you want to do, like this might not be the place for you, but if you want to do better and be more connected with people and have really, this is what you ought to think about. And so there's just a lot, it's a lot of, unfortunately, you know, in business, you get lots of coachable opportunities with people.
So now when you're out there and you're serving more people, mm-hmm. are you finding that your interests have changed from the way that you envision your career kind of going when you first started being an entrepreneur to this version of yourself?
Yeah, it's a really bizarre thing. I'm so not focused on money. Zero focused on money, which I'm sure my investors are loving. But it works. Like, it works out if you just make decisions about the right. If you say, I want to serve my employees well, and my employees to serve my customers well, and that's all I care about. You have very authentic I had to have a conversation with a client, one of our company's clients yesterday. I said, look, we're just not charging you enough. It doesn't make sense for us. It doesn't make sense for you. So there's two choices here. Either we don't do business together, or I need to charge you more so it makes sense. And they said, yeah, that makes sense. Let's do it. So I think if you are authentic with your employees and they're authentic with the customers,
right,
you're set. And then you just make choices about, you know, I talk about in the book, you know, free will drives everything. And most of us have it for about 5 seconds every morning until we realize we have a mortgage and traffic and carpool and free will dissipates. But there's about 5 seconds in the morning you wake up and you really have free will.
And then after that, you got to figure it out.
Got to figure it out. You got to figure out what choices you want to make.
Now, for that person that maybe in the corporate world that was laid off or has these dreams of startup life, that's this party, you know, with foosball and Red Bull. In the book, I thought was pretty strong language that you a lot of times advise them when they come to you that you should really stay where you're at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's not like that they should reassess the either their vision of startup life is not what they think it what it really is, or that maybe they just won't be the right fit.
Yeah. Well, what I try to explain to people in startups, you start all over. I don't care if you were VP of whatever and had a $1 billion budget. You come work for a startup, you're at the bottom rung. Like, you are learning and reteaching yourself everything all over. Those experiences you bring with you are really not that valuable. It might help you learn faster, but it's not going to give you a leg up. And most people don't want to hear that. Well, I was the VP of sales at Equifax. Well, okay. But, you know, I did X, Y, and Z. I'm like, great. I need you to go raise $1 million in 2 weeks. Can you do that? Well, where are my tools? I'm like, here's a business card. Go do it. They don't know what to do, right? So you really are starting over. So I try to explain to them, if you're willing to relearn your entire career, then you should absolutely do it. If you are about learning and wanting to start over, absolutely do it. If you think what you've learned to date will add any value to where you think you're going to contribute to the startup, you're absolutely wrong.
Now, when you tell that to a corporate executive that's used to picking up the phone, everybody returns their call because mm-hmm. their logo is the right one.
Right.
And then now they're in a startup world where no one knows who this startup is. And all those buddies you had maybe weren't really buddies after all. Do they go, well, thanks, KP, I think I'm going to reassess? Or they're like, you don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I learned that, like, you want to give people, I try not to be too aggressive. I call it self-evident decisioning. I just try to give people all the facts so they make the decision themselves. Mm-hmm. If you tell someone you shouldn't do this, their first inclination is to go do it, right? So you have to kind of really paint the picture that, you know, you're mapping them through. So here's what a day in the life looks like. And by the way, you're the senior most person on the team. When we run out of payroll and I need to raise $1.5 million in a week, everyone is going to look at you. So you better have $1.5 million in the bank, or you better have friends that will write checks for that, because that's how that will play out. And people will always ask, well, if you've had such a great career, why haven't you invested money?
Right.
And you better have a good answer for that, because the expectation is if you were a VP at Coca-Cola for 30 years, you can't write a $1 million check. You weren't that successful. That's how investors will look at it.
And they don't. This is eye-opening for a lot of people, I would imagine. Mm-hmm.
Right, because they think it's just a different job. It's about down, you know, they don't realize that level of connectivity between your previous accomplishment and investing and being an investor and being engaged on the financial level. Hey guys, we're not making payroll this week. Sorry.
Yeah, that didn't happen at Equifax.
That didn't happen. Well, it might have.
It might have now.
Recently.
So what's the mission for the book? What are you going to celebrate with regard to the book? Is there speaking engagements as well and more writing and thought leadership coming behind it? Or what do you got in mind?
I've always spoke a lot. You know, this year I'm booked about 18 different speaking gigs this year, independent of the book. I think I've been talking about this in my speaking gigs already. So I think there's no real packaging around it. It really started off as a personal project. There was no really monetization around it.
Right. But the money's going to follow. We already established that, right?
I think it kind of already is. Yeah. So now,
what advice do you have for a young person that's thinking of, you know, they're just out of college and they have a lot of choices and they're thinking, okay, on one hand, I can do this startup route, or another hand, I can get this kind of corporate-y job. How do you help them kind of weigh the pros and cons of each path?
So I always tell people, like, you should go work for a corporate. If anything, you will learn the way they do things wrong. And then they do some things right, right? You start to understand that construct, because eventually, if your startup is successful, you will become that big company.
Right.
It's inevitable, right? It's absolutely inevitable. So it's important to understand that, so you make decisions along the way for that not to happen too fast. But there is something around getting out of college and understanding something, having deep content around a topic. The problem with startups is you do a little bit of everything, you know, and you never get deep on anything.
Mm-hmm.
So at least if you go to a company and you're in marketing, you understand, you actually build an entire marketing plan and actually execute on it,
right,
which never happens.
Right.
Right, which never happens in a startup. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just writing and rewriting your plan.
Right,
and
it's tweaking, a lot of
right.
pivoting.
Exactly. So I think there's a big benefit to getting that under your, you know, in your career. And then what I really coach people on is become an expert at something. And try to get as technical as you can. The world of the salesperson that follows a script and, you know, goes through a process, those days are gone. They really are. Right now, what customers, when you're selling, whether an investor or a customer, they want to know that you know more about the topic than they do, like genuinely. And you can out-talk them. You know, you can out-knowledge them. And so it's really important to go deep on topics and really become an expert at topics.
And then, so when they're doing that, how do you recommend them playing that out? So just go get a corporate job and just kind of immerse themselves in one specific niche of that company,
yeah,
or that task?
Yeah, exactly. And what I really coach them on is, forget about the company for a second. Really focus on your hiring. Who are you working for? Because the company, you know, working at Coca-Cola, there's plenty of great managers there. There's plenty of horrible managers there. It comes down to who you're going to work for and who's going to be your mentor, because that person will, in your early career, can change your life. My mentor, when I first, my first job out of college, said, "KP, let me tell you something. The guy with the most clients wins. That's all you need to know. You can mess up anything else." Mess up everything else. And I've lived that, you know.
Now, how do you coach a young person about selling, the importance of selling and the kind of tricks of the trade of selling?
If you can't sell, you can't do nothing.
So no matter what your job is, even if you're an accountant, you have to be...
Yeah. I mean, look, sales is about communicating value and really communicating in a very clear way. And that's whether it's to a customer or to Wall Street, which CFOs have to do, right? They have to sell. It's really trying to communicate the value and how you're in your approach in a very clear way to a customer or to a market. And I think people think sales is a negative thing. It's like, oh, I never want to be a salesperson. Then you should probably stay right where you're at, because that's, I mean, 90% of the job in a startup is selling. Whether you're selling, hiring a new employee, trying to get people to come work for you, and you have the money.
Right, I mean, that's salesmanship.
Salesmanship right there.
Now, what, you're getting a lot of feedback from the book. Is there any piece of feedback you've gotten that you've been most proud of?
Yeah, a good friend of mine is in the music industry, and he's an entrepreneur. Well, you know, if I named his artists, you know them all. He was out with his kids at a Dave & Buster's or something. He's like, "Hey, I just packed your book along just to nod through it, to go through it a little bit." And he's like texting me the play-by-play. And he's like, "This is the first book I've read through cover to cover in 8 years. And he's like, "My kids were bugging me, like, hey, Dad, come do this." And like, I finished the book while I was there at Dave & Buster's. And that was really cool for someone that, has been through a lot in terms of his entrepreneurial career, and he's had ups and downs with plenty of superstars. But for him to say, "Hey, this is like super meaningful. I want to reread it. I wish I would have had this 20 years ago." Like, and I think when you hear from people, it's nice to hear from young people like, "Oh, this will really help me shape my future." When you hear from people that have highly experienced saying, "I wish I had this 20 years ago," that's super meaningful to me.
And for your future, KP, what type of impact do you want to make in the world?
Honestly, right now, it's just been focused on my kids. The boys are 17 and 15 now. And really raising fine young men. I mean, it's a big job. My 17-year-old dating now, which I'm sure he's thrilled at disclosing this. But you know, he comes home and it's a constant conversation of like, how do you treat people? How do you treat women? And the narrative in the marketplace right now, if you're not having 15 conversations with your kids right now, like, there's just not enough hours in the day. They came home and they're, "Dad, did you hear about Aziz Ansari?" I'm like, let's sit down and talk about it. I mean, like, there's so much to do as a parent right now. I've been pretty focused on that.
So that's the end of the day high five will be, you have two well-balanced young men.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Now, if somebody wants to get a hold of the book, what's the best way to find it?
Amazon is the easiest way. And go on Amazon and search What You Know About Startups Is Wrong or KP Ready. I do have one other book. It's a textbook. Please avoid that. You'll be bored. It's not the same. It's a master's degree technical book. You'll be bored out of your mind.
So it's the bright yellow cover.
Bright yellow cover. Yeah.
Well, I love the title. I love the idea even more. And Lee was bragging about the book because he did read it before we came on air. I have not read it yet. I did scan the list of chapters as we were beginning the conversation earlier, and several jumped out at me. I'm really looking forward to diving into this thing, man. Thank you for doing
it. Yeah, thank you. It was work.
Well, keep up the good work, and you know, if there's another book in you, please don't hesitate, man.
There may be. You never know. On my next retirement.
There you go. Hey, listen, how about hanging out with us for a bit? We got two more we're going to visit with.
All right, sounds good.
All right, next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us President of Licensing Brands, Inc., Mr. Pete Canalicchio. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. Good afternoon. Good to be here.
It's good to have you back. I mean, it's old home week here, right?
It's good to be back. It's a lot of fun.
Now, oddly enough, you've written a book as well. It's not quite out yet?
It literally was published officially yesterday. I'm still waiting to get them in my hands. And I've been told that Amazon sold out, which I don't really understand, but okay.
Well, that's good news. All right. Expand, grow, thrive. 5 proven steps to turn good brands into global brands through the Lasso method. So looking forward to learning about that.
So you want to talk a little bit about it? What's the Lasso method?
Sure. The Lasso method is a way of thinking about whether or not your brand is optimally expanded or not. And Lasso came from the original title of the book when I was thinking about writing it about 8 years ago, and which was Lasso the World's Greatest Brands. And from that, my co-creator, Mark DeSoma, who's a Kiwi, he and I came up with an acronym LATERAL, for meaning from category to category: addictive, storied, scalable, and ownable. Those are the 5 attributes a brand needs to have in order to be able to expand. And so there's different graduations of that, from 1 to 5 is a score. And you can go on to pkenalicchio.com/lasso and put your scores in, and we'll tell you whether or not there's an algorithm, tell you whether or not you're underexpanded or optimally expanded. And in the future, overexpanded.
Now, before we dive deeper into the book, can you talk a little bit about your background? What makes you kind of qualified to be able to give advice about branding?
Sure. I was listening to KP and talking about Coca-Cola, and I was like, that's in my background. I'm former Navy pilot, Naval Academy, then UNC Business School, and then recruited to Coca-Cola in the early 90s. I actually started out in finance. And after 5 years, I got bored crunching numbers. So I jumped over to marketing, which was a lot more fun. And through that, fell into a group called Worldwide Licensing about 20 years ago. And interestingly enough, I worked on the Nagano Olympic Games, the Winter Olympics, and I've been on working with Coca-Cola on the Winter Olympics for everyone since Sochi, and feels a little weird not to be in Pyeongchang right now. But that was part of it. And then I got to work for the Newell Rubbermaid Company and ran Rubbermaid's global licensing business. And in fact, I was in the building right next door to where you guys are situated.
And so you've been in this world for a while, so you know where all the landmines are and where the opportunities are?
A fair number. I certainly don't think I know all of them. And that's why the book has more than 36 industry experts that I interviewed, plus dozens of other examples. I gave one of mine and touched on a few others, but mostly it's everybody's contributions to this.
And is there, can you share one or two of those stories?
Sure. For example, I interviewed a gentleman named Rick White, who used to run Major League Baseball properties. And he talked about in the old days before all the teams came together and had one program, every team was doing its own thing. And oddly enough, the Milwaukee Brewers had the biggest program, which wasn't very big at the time.
The biggest in number of?
Licensed merchandise.
Uh-huh.
So like t-shirts and ball caps and bat, whatever the replica merchandise was. And so it was his job to pull it all together, and everybody came together except for the Yankees, who kind of waited and watched and saw. Yeah. And over a short period of time, he got everybody to sign up effectively. And one of the first things he came out with was the replica jerseys and things like that. And that blew up because people wanted to wear what the players were wearing on the field.
And that was... They had never done that before?
They had never done that before. And it's kind of like wheel. I always analogize things to wheels on suitcases. Like, why did it take hundreds of years for wheels to get on suitcases?
Yeah, that's a good point.
And if you gave me a $1,000 bag that didn't have wheels, I would not accept it. I mean, no, thank you. But then from there, he went and did throwback Cooperstown collection.
Right.
And that came out of something that was going on in Brooklyn, where somebody was actually doing Brooklyn Dodger merchandise, even though the Dodgers were in LA. And so they were able to pull all that together, and $600 million in sales in the first year. So pretty exciting stuff.
So now how does a brand know if there's going to be kind of an audience for it, this type of extension of it?
So the first thing is your brand has to be loved. Lots of folks who come to me don't really have a brand. They have a trademark and they're thinking about it. But if the brand is not, you know, have huge advocates and huge loyalty, then the likelihood of it being able to expand will be difficult through licensing, because the licensees or the manufacturers are the ones that are making the majority of the investments. So therefore, they have to know that adding your brand to their product or service is actually going to help it sell better.
Mm-hmm.
But if we look at the Lasso model, you look at, okay, how easily can it move from a category to category? And that comes from the idea of whether is it emotive or not. So things that are emotive have a much more of an easier way to expand from one category to another, because it's about something emotional. So for example, Ferrari can go into anything speed related because that's what they stand for, speed. But like M&M Mars, they're phenomenal at doing confectionery. So they really can't get out of that category. And similarly with addictiveness, right? Do you have a Pokemon Go kind of product, or is yours something that people will pick up and put back down, and et cetera, et cetera. For example, scalable. You know, FIFA World Cup is the most scalable, you know, sports property on the planet. Are you restricted to your local ballpark, or, you know, can you actually get out of your region and into lots of other regions?
And speaking of soccer, did you foresee the popularity of the Atlanta team here?
That's a kind of a little bit of an interesting question. Now that I see that it's popular, it makes sense. Would I have said that it would be successful? I probably would not have without a lot of research. But I think there's enough folks who love the game that's convinced those of us who didn't know the game that it's worth watching.
And then, so when you're working with a brand, how do you kind of walk them through the process? Like, how do you manage their expectations? Because some people might think that their brand is emotive and scalable, but you're going to kind of help them understand where they fit into the...
After they write you the check. First they write you the check, then you start telling them the truth, right? That's how it works, KP?
That's where I think, you know, gets back to KP's philosophy of just, you know, doing the right thing and it'll work out. I think that's the way I'm doing it. But I will always say, listen, you know, as we look at a brand hierarchy, it starts with awareness. Is your brand... Do people know your brand? Have they tried your brand? Do they prefer your brand? Are they loyal to your brand? Are they insistent on your brand? Insistence, for example, I was in Jackson Hole last week doing some skiing. I had a break at lunchtime and wanted a Coke. And the guy says, is Pepsi okay? And I say, no, thank you. It's because I'm insistent on Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately advocacy. Are people advocating your brand? So the higher you are along that hierarchy, the more likelihood is that your brand will be successful into other categories and that licensees will want it. But then you have to look at that lasso model and say, are you an emotive brand like a Coca-Cola? Or, you know, as we said, you know, some of the other brands like Ferrari, for example, or Harley Davidson.
Okay. So you find someone finds you and you decide, yeah, you're making pretty good marks in all these categories. Now what happens? Are there people like in your Rolodex, and for you young people that don't know what a Rolodex is, we'll include a definition in the publishing post.
How does that work, right?
Yeah. Now who do I call? Pete tells me, yes, Stone, you got something here.
So then it's really about, you know, understanding what categories you're going to enter and then finding out who is manufacturing products in that category. More than manufacturing, actually, they make marketplace. They have business, they have distribution. They are actually selling their own products in the category that your brand should go into. And now you're going to complement their products by adding your brand to it. So they're not going to learn how to get into a new channel or a new region on the back of your brand. They already know how to go into those new channels and new regions. But with your brand, that product is going to be much more well served. And consumers are going to go after it because you've looked at all those different areas and said, this is very, very successful in, you know, its ability to move from category to category. It's scalable. It's completely addictive. And it's got a wonderful story. Okay, I'll put that on my brand, on my product, and we'll be highly successful. So that's kind of the way to think about it. And, you know, the best brands are the ones that are going to be the most attracted. It's kind of that top 10% get 80% or 90% of the folks who are going after them, right? Because they're so well loved.
Now, does this translate to personal brands as well?
Absolutely. It's interesting. I was doing a lecture a couple weeks ago for a group that supports servicemen and women transitioning from the military to the civilian world. And I was talking about personal branding and using that hierarchy as an example and saying, we have to think of ourselves as brands. Brands in the past used to be very kind of narrowly defined, but now brands are sports teams and celebrities and you know, corporate brands and characters. And now, yes, you are a brand and everything communicates. So you have to be consistent with who you are every time you are connecting with someone. And that's whether you're digitally connecting, physically connecting, your image, et cetera. So that, and it was funny because I had set up some stuff and I had brought a jacket with me. And so I said, before we're going to get started, I'm going to put that jacket on because that's part of who I am and everything communicates. So.
So you're leveraging this same concept you do for companies for yourself, and you're kind of positioning yourself as an expert, writing a book, speaking. That's all part of how you're kind of licensing your brand?
Absolutely. One of the things that I say that brands do is help reduce risk, right? If you go into a drugstore and you have a sick child and you need some kind of medication to drop their fever, are you going to go with the generic brand or are you going to go with a Tylenol, for example? You happily pay the difference to know that you have complete trust in that product. And that difference between generic and the brand is the factor of which you're willing to pay. That's part of a definition of a brand. So if somebody comes to me because they've seen me write, you know, in Forbes or an entrepreneur or my book, and I have successful examples, then their level of risk is reduced.
Now, for you, you're using the book to go out and do more speaking, to get more business. What was the marketing kind of utility part of the book?
This story was in me since I launched my company back in 2009, almost 9 years ago. It was part of my desire to help elevate the level of quality, of understanding of how brands expand for the community that I work in, plus to shed some light on this industry, which is $160+ billion industry for lots of folks who don't even know it exists. Mm-hmm. And so the educational element's always been something that's been important to me, and I've developed a whole host of self-help tools and self-study courses. And I'm excited to say that I'm going to be teaching a course in branding and brand expansion at Mercer starting next month using the book. So, you know, it's kind of neat to be able to say, here's a book that hopefully is fairly readable with lots of great stories, and it's your textbook.
Professor Pete.
Yeah. So
I like it.
And I want to talk more about it. I want to be the evangelist for this industry and to tell folks why it's so important, because when you combine a great brand with a great product or service, consumers get the opportunity to buy and engage in those products and enhance their fandoms and universes so much more than they would without the product, because the product by itself may never, ever get enough awareness anybody's going to use it.
Now, do you find that most companies, this is a missed opportunity, that there are opportunities to leverage their brand through licensing that they're just not taking?
I think there's so many companies that this is a missed opportunity on the branding side, but I would say even more on the licensee side, the ones that are licensing the brands in. I had a short lecture about not quite a year ago at University of Georgia's Terry School, and I was saying, you know, to this group of marketing students, if you acquire the right brand, you can increase your revenue by 2x, 3x, even sometimes 4x. And I saw all these skeptical faces, and I was like, honestly, this is the truth. And a guy to my right raised his hand. I said, yeah, what do you want to share? He goes, well, we had a great product. We licensed in a brand that was fairly well known, and our revenue increased by 10 times. And I said, okay, I'll pay you later. but that's the truth. So there's a lot of companies that have great products and services that don't have great brands. And they're the ones that should be understanding the brands out there that they can fit with, in order to be able to enhance those brands and enhance their own revenue.
So now, what would be an example of how a brand could kind of go to a licensee or go about licensing? Yeah.
So I've got an 8-step process that basically says, where can the brand play? What categories does the brand have permission to enter? And then of those categories, which ones actually reinforce the brand's position and promise? And then once you know what those categories are, then the second step is to say, okay, are we going to create this product ourselves, manufacture it and market and sell it? Are we going to source it? Or are we going to go outside the company? We're going to acquire another company that does it? Or are we going to extend our brand via licensing? And once you decide that that's the right route to take, and by the way, licensing can be a great route to acquisition because you can test the company before you actually buy them, mm-hmm. which can reduce the risk of actually merging later. Then you go find out who out there is making these products. And that's lots of research on the internet, but it's also going into retail stores and literally physically picking up products in the category that you want and finding out who's manufacturing them. It's going to trade shows. So it's all these different ways of finding out who's out there making those products and then engaging them. And first doing some research. Okay, are they top in their category? Do they have the right attributes for us? And then once you've engaged them, do they have an interest? And if it's a great brand, likelihood is that they're going to at least pay attention for a little bit. And then from there, you can start to do your due diligence, and then you set your terms and write your contract, and then work really hard through an orientation and business planning to make them successful because you've worked so hard in getting that agreement together.
But this isn't only for B2C companies though, right?
No.
You can work in B2B as well.
When I worked at Newell Rubbermaid, I did the Rubbermaid commercial products brand, and we actually extended the brand into trash can liners, which you would have thought that Rubbermaid had made, but they didn't really have a business in that. So we went and found the top four businesses that were making commercial trash can liners and went to them and said, we want to extend our brand via licensing into this category. We have the world's greatest trash cans. We need the liners. And we went through that whole process and ended up licensing our brand to the number one in the industry. And it was a very successful program.
Could it work as well too, like in a B2B setting in like professional services?
Absolutely. It's one of those where if you look at your product or service and say, if I had a brand with it, would it enhance my ability to communicate to my end user, in the case of B2B, in such a way that they would benefit? And if the answer is yes, then you should really start to figure out which brands out there make the most sense to connect with your service. And then get to understand them better and then have a conversation with them about why extending into this particular service would actually help them.
Good stuff. Well, good stuff.
Well, I just want to again, I always go back to the whole sales and marketing side of things. You have a consulting practice of, yes, of some fashion. How does the whole sales and marketing thing work for you? Are you busy? People, are your phone ringing off the hook? Or do you have to go out and try to explain the value of having these conversations? How does that whole piece work?
Yeah, so like I come from a marketing paradigm, and I totally agree again with KP on the sales side, right? Marketing is the tool you use to get the person to engage with you, and then selling is the skill set in order for them to actually agree to.
Well, you got
to
bite some of them in the neck, or nobody eats, right, KP?
But in this case, I'm really working hard on getting my my brand out there and getting my message out there, and then from there, folks engage me, and then I know I have a warm lead, and then we can have a conversation about how I can help them. So it's much better for everyone if they've found me because they were looking for something and they think I can help them with a solution versus me cold calling them. That usually never works.
And you're going to latch onto that Professor Pete idea, aren't you? I can see those wheels turning. You already have the whole package in place.
My goal is that all the universities in the world are going to pick up this, because you cannot take a course in brand expansion through licensing. I say you cannot. There's probably a handful of programs around the world that teach this.
Right. You had to learn it, you know, the real way.
You fall into this industry. Right. You literally fall into it. And that's what I did. I was working on the 96 Olympics, bumped into a woman named Lorianne Goldman, who was running worldwide licensing at the time. And she was working on selling Coca-Cola Atlanta Olympic merchandise in Coca-Cola Olympic City, which I was working on. And the next thing I know, I'm working for her and working on the Nagano Olympics in FIFA 1998 World Cup.
Now there's a book for it.
There you go. So for some of these poor folks out there that don't have their own radio show, how can they get their hands on one of your books?
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of Amazon. So again, I would say go back to Amazon and just search on Expand Growth Thrive. You'll find it. You can also search on Pete Canalicchio, but Expand Growth Thrive is easier to spell.
Well, thanks for coming in and getting us caught up on this. I'm looking forward to reading this as well. There'll be a Kindle version at some point.
There's a Kindle version out right now. I'd love to do an audio version. I'm trying to figure out how best to make that happen.
Right there in that red chair, man. Just come on in and read it. We'll just hand you the book. Lee and I'll go get a cup of coffee.
We'll talk about this later.
Katie will press record. You can read the book. Thanks, sounds man. Great. It's been a lot of fun. And congrats on getting the book out.
Much appreciated.
Yeah. Hey, stay with us. We've got one more guest we're going to visit with.
My pleasure.
Lee, you ready for the headliner?
I am.
All right. He's been very patient. He's been nodding his head. He's been taking notes. He's been laughing at all the jokes, good or bad. I think it's time we let him contribute to the conversation. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast with Odyssey Inc., Jeff Cohen. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back.
Delighted to do it. What'd you learn in those last two segments?
I learned I have a lot to learn about business.
Well, you're doing the Lord's work at Odyssey. Can you talk a little bit about Odyssey Atlanta?
Sure. So Odyssey's mission is to expand the ambitions of Atlanta public school kids. And that means having them be successful in college, career, and their lives. So in Georgia, students are assessed by the Georgia Milestones. So if you're a top performer, you're distinguished. If you're on level, meaning you're ready for the next grade level, you're proficient. And then there's developing and beginner. So in Atlanta, only 50% of third graders are proficient in reading. That means that one out of two are not proficient in reading. They're not ready for the fourth grade. Of eighth graders, only 30% are proficient in science, meaning that they're not ready for ninth grade science. They're below proficiency. If you're lucky to graduate in Georgia, 70% of kids on average graduate, which the numbers are going up. Only 27% of those 70% will complete college. And what that means for business is that there's not enough talented people in the workforce to fill the jobs that are available in Georgia.
Yeah, and we talked to a lot of economic development folks, and that's one of the biggest things that they're trying to use as a selling point is that there is talent here, that there is a pipeline of talent. And if we can't kind of grow our own, we got some problems down the road, don't we?
Right. So that's what Odyssey does. So our program serves 400 Atlanta public school kids. So to qualify to be in the program, you have to be on free and reduced lunch. So you're just above the poverty line. You have to be a B average, which means you're not in remediation. You're not a valedictorian. You're a middle student that's hungry. And you have to be able to engage in a 6-week program. And we want you to do that from grades 1 to 12. So we serve grades 1 to 12 on the Westminster campus. So our partners are Atlanta Public Schools and the Westminster Schools. And our model, our curriculum is project-based learning and STEAM. So project-based learning, that whole model is a Socratic way of teaching that has a driving question. So for example, our eighth grade entrepreneurs, their driving question is, how can I make a product that will make life better for people? And so we only get math and science and English language arts. And then at the end of Shark Tank, to teach them those skills. So we're making it fun. We're making it engaging. The idea that it's authentic. And we focus heavily on STEAM, which is science, technology, engineering, art, and math. As our students get older, those challenges ramp up. So our 11th graders are our filmers. So they'll work with a Channel 11 producer on developing a documentary. So they're learning first-year film school skills, but they're also, they'll work with counselors and coaches on their SATs. So they'll take the SAT, they'll score it, and they'll work on improving it. They'll visit colleges, and they'll work with counselors on writing their actual essays to get into college and their scholarship applications. So our results, we know that our third graders, 85% have improved in math. We know that our eighth graders, 75% have improved in science. 100% of our students graduate high school. And so far, we know that the majority of our students have stayed in college. And our students, remember, they're all low income, are going to schools like West Point, like Cornell, here in Atlanta, like UGA, like Spelman. So they're going to the colleges they want to go to, and they're performing well. And they're the people that you want to hire.
So now, what do you need help in kind of rolling this out to more schools? Because if you have a program that works, shouldn't we? I mean, that's kind of the laws of the startup. I'm going to get KP in this, because when you have something that's scalable, shouldn't you be replicating this and rolling it out?
Yeah, and our business model is really a little bit different. So we launched a strategic plan 5 years ago, and we decided to go deep. So we want 500 students to perform as well as any student in Atlanta, whether they're a private or public school. And that means investing a lot of resources in those 400. So we do serve all of Atlanta schools, but we only serve 400. We're not looking to go to scale until we've perfected that model, and all 400 of those kids can make their dreams come true.
So it's all or nothing?
All or nothing.
What's the thinking behind that? Like, why do it that way?
Because the gap is so wide for equity in Atlanta that we want to make sure that the students that we serve can really accomplish what they want to accomplish. Programs like all nonprofits, if you think of even our own success rate, so we used to say we graduate 100% of our students from high school, which all programs in Atlanta, that was their headliner. Well, that's great, but if only 27% of those kids are graduating from college, then we failed. We failed those kids. So they're not ready for the workforce. So we're investing more resources to make sure that we're working not only during the summer, but with year-round counselors, right, and with our college alumni.
So do you need more help in the instruction? Like, where's the gaps?
Well, we always need help recruiting, because we want to make sure every student is able to apply to be in our program, that they're aware of what we do. So you have to compete to get into Odyssey. It's not automatic. Right. It's free. We invest $2,500 per child, but they pay $35, just a simple registration fee. That includes transportation, college tours, breakfast and lunch, all the equipment. They have to bring nothing. They have to pay nothing.
But do you have enough instructors to instruct the 500 students?
Well, our instructors were fortunate, because we bring master teachers from public and private school to lead the classes. So our film teacher is a Channel 11 producer. Our counselor, Dr. Shropshire, is College Counselor of the Year for Cobb County. So we attract the talent because they're passionate about their work, and they get to do, Odyssey lets them do it in a fun way that's creative, that's engaging, that is less restrictive than they can do in their normal.
So you have the 500 students, you have the instructors, and you're just waiting for them to graduate to make sure you have the right success rate?
Well, every year we bring those students back. So every year we're measuring their success.
Right.
So, and remember that we're working with students that have a lot of challenges in their life.
Right.
So things change, like in all our lives, from second to third grade or from eighth grade to ninth grade. So we're never done. So we want to make sure that a second grader is ready for third grader. And if they come back for third grade, maybe they're ready for fifth grade. And if they're going into high school, they're already thinking about college. And if they're in college, we developed a Career Quest program to expose them to careers so they can start thinking about what are the jobs out there besides doctor, lawyer, musician that I might think about. Could I be an entrepreneur? Could I write a book? Could I be a teacher? So those are things that we look at every year. And our students, we hope come back every year, but we're always recruiting new students as well.
So what do you need from us? How can we help you?
Well, we need financial support. And we always want to have, to support our program, is $2,500 a student. So we invite corporations and foundations to contribute to what we do. We are still always looking, especially in the high school, to make sure that every child knows about our opportunity and can take advantage of it. So we are always looking to recruit students. So the students that we have, we're not a school. So students can opt in or out of our program every year. So we want to make sure that every student knows about what we do.
Now, what's your retention? Are they opting in?
We have about 75% year-over-year retention, which is good for the population that we work with. So some of our students have been from third grade all the way through college. And then some students may stay a year and they may be deported. They may get evicted. They may move out of the district.
Move, right. Yeah. So now the intention, though, of this is to eventually roll, if this is as successful as you hope it is, isn't it, to roll it out so you can impact more students?
We would love to expand the model once we're ready to bring it to scale.
Can he license the model if he gets it figured out, Pete?
Absolutely.
Well, I'd like KP's thought. This is, I mean, if you're in the startup world, this is how much more data do you need?
Well, I mean, I think their point about like trying to be 100% successful, this is also a long game. You know, when people talk about, I get hit up all the time, like, what do we need to be doing in STEM? Like, well, whatever you do today, I may not be alive like to see the results, right? I mean, it's a long game. So getting like quantitative metrics of success, you do all this great work and it's really 5-10 years from now that you can say, you can point to the case study. So that's always the challenge in terms of trying to scale. But I think trying to get 100% success rate through, I mean, this is people's lives, right? This isn't like, oh, you went to a cohort and you got funded, right? Those are all things that happen in 6 months. These are long cycles, right? And there's a lot of, I think the biggest thing I see is there's a lot of programs out there.
Right.
And how to get them all playing well. I mean, I think that's where the scale. There's a lot, the passion that around the people that run these programs is tremendous. And they're always under-resourced and under, I mean, nobody's like, oh, I have so much money, I don't know what to do with it.
We have too much money.
Sorry. you know, and I think what I've seen is like how they collaborate and kind of create real ecosystems. And that's where corporations can really support too.
Where they can kind of be the connector to help maybe disparate ones kind of work together.
Right, because it's, I mean, what would be great is if a kid moves out of the area, that they go to an area where there is another program. Maybe it's not Odyssey, but it's a different program.
Or complementary.
Right. Something, you know, and that there is collaboration. I do a lot of work with Europe here in town, which is, so I've done a lot of work with them. And that's a different segment. It's a little bit of a different population, different age group, but everybody should be talking to you. I mean, I think that's what we've done in the Atlanta ecosystem is getting everybody talking to everybody. And, you know, the flow is where it goes to like the right fit. You know, the kids end up in the right place in the right spot.
So now for Odyssey, how what's on the roadmap for you guys?
Well, what we've launched this past year is a year-round counseling program. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is really work with the students, especially in high school and middle school, of their college. Where are they going to college? But before that, if you're in eighth grade, what classes are you taking in ninth grade? Should you be in the IB program? Should you take advanced placement, on-level, accelerated? And if you have a career tech, what's the right way to follow that track? And then really to lay out, so here are your scores. Here's the funding you think you have. Here's the college you should be looking at. Here's some stretch schools. And here's some schools you definitely should be applying to.
And then part of your program that's unique is this level of personal mentorship, and they're kind of following them pretty closely, right? This isn't like I just show up and I teach my class and leave.
Exactly. So we have mentors that work one-on-one with our older students. Mm-hmm. And then we try to work with our students year-round to be active in their lives, to really know what's going on, to be able to influence them. And then in a group way, we bring them to these Career Quest events where they do get to visit corporations, whether it's Coca-Cola or Home Depot, and sit in a room like this and meet with executives and say, well, what do you want to do when you were 16? And what are you doing now?
So the executives are interviewing them, or the kids are interviewing the executives?
It's really just a conversation about, If I want to do what you do, what should I do? Mm-hmm. Or if I want to be a doctor, I know you're not a doctor, what do you suggest? And you always hear a story like, well, I wanted to be a doctor too. And then I found out I fell in love with marketing. Or I fell in love with, I got to do a video and everyone clapped. So I fell in love with broadcast journalism.
So now, how do parents or the students, who applies? Is it the parent or the student that applies for this?
The students apply. The younger students, the parents are active. and they can find an application on our website. Mm-hmm. So that's at www.odysseyatlanta.org.
And then for you, you're going out and you're meeting with businesses to, you want to partner with them. Like what are you doing?
Exactly. So we work with businesses on different levels. So for example, for our Shark Tank, we have entrepreneurs from the Atlanta Tech Village that will come in and be our sharks. Mm-hmm. We have volunteers, business resource groups in the bigger companies that will come in and volunteer to do maybe a cookout for the students. And then we have some one-on-one mentors that really work with a young man or young lady on their specific plans. So there's a lot of different ways to engage. And then, you know, we always need sponsors to develop our programs. So we just finished our annual brunch, which was successful. And we have upcoming in the summer, we'll have our annual 5K. So we're always looking for sponsors to, and volunteers to help with
this. So you have a few fundraisers throughout the year and you have an ongoing kind of relationship with the business people that just kind of just talk to the students and interact with them as best they can in different forums.
Exactly. We have different formats for them to engage.
And then do you have any kind of job shadowing opportunities where the students can job shadow some of these people?
Well, we've developed our Career Quest program. Mm-hmm. So that's in a way for them, because it's easier for the executives, to be honest. So they'll go in around lunchtime and spend 2 hours. Uh-huh. And so it's kind of job shadowing, fast forward. And
where they can do a bunch of kids at the same time.
Exactly. And then if they're interested in internships, they can circle back and apply for an internship with those companies.
And then it goes all the way through college, or it ends when they get to college?
Well, our formal program ends at high school graduation. Mm-hmm. But our new programs, we're developing our alumni to really stay with them through college.
Because now you want them to give back for the younger kids?
Exactly. To give back and just to make sure that they complete college, so that mm-hmm. they know they have a resource they can depend on when things get rough. When, you know, a lot of kids drop out because they didn't have $500 for books. Right. Or they got an invoice they didn't know how to pay.
Right.
Or they didn't realize they had to complete their FAFSA in year three, not just year one. And so those are things. Or it's just they get to Cornell or they get to Brown and they just feel like, I don't belong here, even though they do belong there.
Right.
And so it's helping them through those rough spots that we all have. And we're trying to be a resource for them. And then when they're interested in jobs, to connecting them to individuals that can offer them internships.
Now, for you, can you share maybe a story from one of the students that you're the most meaningful to you?
Sure. You know, every year there's so many. The one that she just spoke at our event, so stands out. Her name is Reem. Sorry, Reem, I'm not supposed to say your name on radio. But Reem is an Ethiopian immigrant. So she's been here since she's 2 years old. And her father ran a trucking company in Ethiopia. But, you know, because of the wars and troubles there, brought the family here. And so he drives a shuttle at the Atlanta airport. And he's been doing that for 20 years because he wants to make sure his kids can have the opportunities that weren't available in Ethiopia. And so Reem has been in our program since third grade. And, you know, as she grows, she develops. So when she was at MLK, she wrote a speech and got to go visit with the Obamas. And then when she was in high school, she started getting scholarships. So now she's at Georgia State and she's in pre-med. And she wants to be a pediatrician. And the reason she wants to be a pediatrician, she wants to get back to the immigrant community where she lives, that she just sees that the healthcare and those issues are so critical, especially for babies and young children. So, you know, those are the students that I love. That they all they're asking for is a chance, and they'll blossom and they really do want to give back.
And if somebody wanted to get a hold of you to learn more, to either donate their time or their money to your organization, what's the best way to get a hold of you guys?
The best way is through our website, and that's www.odysseyatlanta.org.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show and sharing your story.
Thanks for having me back, Lee.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton, our producer, Katie Galley. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.